month, the Chesapeake Big Book Group has been gracious enough to provide our speakers, and our speaker tonight is Jonathan.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jonathan, and I'm an alcoholic. It's an honor to be here, and it's humbling because I know that I'm still a sick alcoholic, and I don't have this all figured out, and then I need help in my journey. I need help from my sponsor, from my fellows in AA, from my God, my higher power, who I call God. And I need it every day, all day, because left to my own devices, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent, and I can't stop drinking or using. I'm 42. My first treatment was when I was 16, and let me take a step back. So my sobriety date is April 26th of 2018, and I got my first buzz when I was about 10 at a family function, and by 12 I was, you know, scrapping for beers, and I was getting into the gateway level substances, and you know, I was blacking out by the time I was 13, mixing stuff together, and you know, getting alcohol poisoning. And my father passed away when I was 15. He was sick with cancer, and when he told me he was dying of cancer, I was high as a kite, and I wasn't able to grieve with him in that moment where he was crying. Everyone was crying, and I was sitting there trying not to laugh. And, I can't get that back. But 6 months later, he was gone, and I did what I was doing already, which was, you know, drinking and using. And you know, my mom's like, you gotta see somebody, a professional. She's like, oh, he needs rehab. So I went, moved in with my aunt and uncle after I got out in California. This is my dad's sister and her husband. They didn't have the kids yet, so they took me in hopes that I could get away from people, places, and things. And I started going to AA. She found me an AA guy, and he sponsored me, and I went to young people's groups, and I stayed sober for almost a year. I'd say a year. I don't remember. It's been a while. But I got so sick and tired of people telling me that if I drink, I'm going to die. I was like, So I went to my uncle's fridge in the garage and cracked open a beer. I took a sip and poured it out. I was like, see? I'm good. And ironically, 6 months later, I was just rebellious, you know, self-centered teenager, and I moved out, and I was getting alcohol poisoning in my new place with my roommates, who told me I party too hard. And I was like, you guys are just weak. You guys are a bunch of sissies. And I put one guy's head through the wall, the other guy put my whole body through the wall, and I ended up having to move out after they trashed the place. And it was a learning experience. But so I ended up getting kicked out of high school my senior year, and got my GED when I was 19, because that girlfriend that I moved in with made me. And I continued getting into really hard substances, and you know, powdery substances, all the different kinds. And by the time I was 21, I was so tweaked out, I didn't want to live anymore. And I went to my mom, my stepdad. I was like, hey, I need help. And, you know, stepdad, I'll call him dad from this point on, because he's been there since I was 3, and my dad doesn't get his feelings hurt anymore when I call him dad. So dad's like, yeah, we're going to send him to treatment, you know. And I went, and I fell in lust with this beautiful girl who happened to be as sick as I was in rehab. And she was gorgeous, so I mean, it was really, there was no fighting it, you know. And so I was like, she wants me, okay, you know. So we got out, moved in together, and it was just not pretty. And you know, her issues my issues, and then the drugs and alcohol. And, you know, so I was like, you know what would really help us out? Joining the Marine Corps. That would help us out. We could just go over there, become tough, and get our stuff together. And we enlisted at the same time, but she left like 6 months before I did for boot camp. So, so you know how that goes. She moved on. And, you know, she did come to my graduation, and I was like, I can't believe you didn't call me. You know, but we had, you know, and then we moved on, and, you know, I found another addiction, and that was being the best Marine I thought I was supposed to be, and I was scared to death of failure. I was 23, and I was like, I'd rather die in Iraq than live a life of shame and guilt that I'm living right now. Because I knew that I wanted to be decent, you know, but it's not what's in here that makes me who I am, it's what I do. And if I keep doing this stuff, that's my character, that's the kind of man I am. And that's the kind of man I was. And there's a lot of shameful things that I did before I went off. You know, stuff I did for drugs. Stuff that you hear about in movies, you know, hear sad stories about, you know, people that do these horrible things or these atrocious things. And but it's interesting because, like, throughout my, you know, I don't know what my alcoholic career, I had the best. I could just forget it all. I could just block it out and just push it away, and it doesn't exist anymore, and I can keep drinking, and it's gonna be okay, you know? So I became a heavier drinker, but I would drink, and I would get up, and I'd run, and I'd work out, and I was like, because I was so afraid of failure, you know, I stepped on people's toes, I stepped on people's backs, and had a pretty successful career for a while, and especially in my early years. And I had all these ideas about, you know, leadership and being a good leader, and but the truth is, I was so scared. I would just try to control everybody, and I was a psychotic asshole. Oh, excuse me. My apologies. There's one. So, you know, I deployed, and you know, I remember feeling alone, just loneliness, you know. And came back to a divorce with a baby that was 4 months old when I left for a year. And I got to, I remember drinking, you know, going to the freezer and chugging whiskey, and my ex-wife never knew. I'd be throwing up in the bathroom. She's like, what's wrong? Like, I ate something, you know? But I wasn't, I was functional. You know, I got the job done. But emotionally, I was a wreck. I got in fights, I got in arguments. I wasn't always a worker among workers. You know, one of the guys, one of the fellows, I was just so afraid of failure that I had to succeed, because that was my only, you know, saving grace in my life, was that I had the Marines. So I get married again, and my youngest daughter, I'm not able to take her with me, and I mean, I drank alcoholically while I was going to college full time at night school, and I was able to graduate and do good. And but it's funny, because, like, you know, my ability to drink and manage and seemingly on the surface be successful just got worse and worse. And, you know, there was episodes where the ambulances had to be called. You know, it was just, it wasn't pretty. And I would, like, I almost convinced myself. I was like, you know, when you're sick, you're supposed to drink liquor because it kills the bacteria. And like, I'm pretty sure she believed me, I mean, I believe me, I think. But I had relationship issues. I was like, well, you know, I have mental health issues. So went and saw the doc, got on some medication, and I kept drinking for 10 years. And medication didn't work that good, you know. And I'd go to therapy, and finally she left me. And we were in Japan, and she left me, and, you know, I was like, oh, my God, what have I done? I love this woman. She's a great woman. I love her. And I swore up and down. I would do everything I could, and I would quit drinking, and with a solemn oath, and I couldn't. And it was just me and my dog now, so, you know, I'd end up with booze and beer every day. I'd be like, I'm not drinking tonight, and somehow the liquor store couldn't be passed without stuff ending up on my person. And I remember thinking, like, I can't stop. And I'm sitting there talking on the phone. I'm like, I'm not drunk. And watching movies and talking to my dog. And, you know, it was just this cycle. And so I ended up going to Substance Abuse On Base and saying, hey, I need help. And they're like, okay, well, once you do the intake, you're ours. If we keep, you know, whatever we say you got to do, you got to do. I was like, fine. So they're like, oh, you need rehab. Inpatient for sure. As much as you drink. And so I went for the third time. And I was like, I mean, I graduated summa cum laude. I was like, pretty sure I was valedictorian. I mean, I was leading meetings, you know. I was a serious overachiever. And I wanted it, you know. And I got out and convinced my psychiatrist that I needed stronger anti-anxiety medications because I'm suffering, you know. And I ended up, you know, getting on the benzodiazepines, which I knew what I was doing. I just wanted to feel better. I just wanted relief, the ease and comfort, right? And if you can't get the ease and comfort of a drink, get it from powder beer, you know, beer and a pill. Which is what it was. And I go to meetings, slurring my words, I was throwing stuff across the room. And finally my sponsor's like, dude, you need to go tell your doctor that you can't take those anymore. And I was like, okay, so I did. And then like I started kind of clearing up a little bit, and people were like, man, you were crazy, bro. I was like, really? I didn't see it, but I heard stories. And I went like, I ended up having to borrow someone's one-year chip to show my command that I had been sober for a year. I ended up talking my ex-wife into letting me drink. She's like, you know, I never really had a problem with you drinking. It was just how much, you know? So if I just have a few, it's not a problem. She's like, no, it's not a problem. I was like, waiter, you know? And that's how it continued, you know? Interesting thing, about 5.5 years ago, you know, I'm sitting here drinking scotch, just, you know, every night, going on the back patio, drink, and usually after the kids get down, or I'd have a few before that, you know. My brother calls me, and he was on the same road that I was on, same path when we were young, and he never got off that path. And he was living in a warehouse. He lost his family, lost his job, lost his freedom. Lost his credit. He's living in a warehouse with a needle in his arm, and I'm the only big book he's ever seen. So he calls me up. You know, he's like having hallucinations, and you know, in the middle of nowhere, someone's following me, and I'm like, I know what your problem is, you know. So I flew to Houston, took him to meetings, and I would drink afterwards, because you got to drink after AA meetings if you're not in the program. And you got to, man. And I had to pound him. I was like, and I even took him to a bar with me one time. How sick is that? You know, I'm trying to help him, but I'm so miserable that I have to drink immediately. And we got him into a good treatment center. It was the only one I ever heard of that was strictly Big Book. That's all I did, was meetings and working the steps, and everyone has chores, and it was like exactly what he needed, because he's 5.5 years clean and sober today. And he's got his life back, and he's got his kids back, and he's got a job, and he's responsible, and he's generous and loving member of this fellowship. He lives it. He does it every day. He walks the walk as best as he can. And so that was kind of a wake-up call for me as I'm drinking in the airport and drinking in the freaking plane with the kids and, you know, could not, you know how it is. And I get back home, and I looked in the mirror at some point, and I seriously, because he had lost like 60 pounds, and he was really, and he had been really big, so, and we're getting older, so now we look a lot more alike. And I looked at myself in the mirror, and I saw my brother's face. I saw his face looking back at me, and I was like, you got to go back to AA. You got to. And I did. And I was like crying in the room. I was like, I need a sponsor. Somebody come help me, please. And my sponsor came and talked to me. And we started meeting once a week and going through the first 164 pages of the big book, line by line, studiously, underlining stuff, talking about it, and working the steps the way the book says to work the steps. And you know, I even started sponsoring somebody who's still sober today. He's got a lot more sobriety than me. But once I got done working the steps, I didn't continue working the steps. You know, I didn't read 86 and 87. I definitely didn't have memorized. I wasn't doing it every morning and every night, if at all. You know, I wasn't calling my sponsor every day. I wasn't praying. I didn't develop a conscious contact with a higher power. I did come to believe. And it's interesting because in my whole life, I've sought spirituality. I've gone to churches. I've had fleeting emotional experiences, but nothing that ever kept me believing and having faith. And I envied people that had it. I'm like, how could you do that? I wish I could have that, but I can't. I try and it just goes away. But when I came to believe through reading through agnostics, and I never stopped believing after that. Even when I went out, I never stopped believing. I always believed there was God after that. And it's just a miracle. Because, you know, this is a God program. You know, the book says it, you know, and I mean, we call it higher power. I think it's whatever you want to call it. It's the same thing. It's the spirit of the universe. It's, you know, it's the one that created the laws of physics and, you know, everything else. The Big Bang, well, someone made that happen. And it's just the more I come around and try to grow, the more... the more I see. It's interesting because it's like this book I read called "The A New Pair of Glasses." It really is like a new pair of glasses. You know, sobriety recovery is seeing the world from a different place. You know, the fourth dimension that's talked about in the book, it's incomprehensible. How can I comprehend something that I have never experienced? I can't. So backtracking to 9 months to 30 days sober, I went on a business trip. And after 2 days of watching everyone else drinking, I was like, I asked my boss for permission to drink. I was like, hey, you don't mind if I have drinks with you, you know? I'm like, I'm a grown man, why would I have to? I asked him for permission, and that was my okay to drink. And I proceeded to drink. And then I spent another year and some change after that trying to get sober, coming into meetings drunk, hating everybody, judging a lot of people. You know, I'm drunk and I got more better recovery than you, man. You know? And you know, just judgmental and sick and miserable. But I kept coming back. You know, I kept saying to myself, you know, the mantra, you know, keep coming back, it works if you work it. Work it. And I believed that because I'd had that for a little bit. You know, that little bit of sobriety that I had showed me that it's possible, that it can be done. And the joys of that time were something that I wanted to get back. And it took me a year and a half or so to do that. And I had to go through, which was incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I got to a point, even when I got sober this time, the first few months, 2 to 3 months, I knew I wasn't going to stay sober. I knew it was impossible to stay sober, given my track record. There's no way I'm going to stay sober. I want to stay sober, but it's impossible. I can't do it. And I was like, well, if I can't stay sober and I can't drink, what's the point of being alive, right? And that's where I came to. But, you know, it was interesting. I heard a guy, a friend in the rooms, Jay, say, you know, my old sponsor said it's somewhere around 70 days that, you know, you start to get over that hump, that obsession. And looking back, it kind of was around there, somewhere around there. And that's not science, but that was my experience. It went away. The obsession to drink went away. And it wasn't because I stopped drinking. It was because I got a sponsor and I started going through the steps again. My old sponsor fired me, by the way. And I started going through the steps, and I really spent a lot more time on the first step. You know, one thing that we did, which is not in the big book, but we actually made a list of bottoms. A list of bottoms. Anything that a normal person would consider a reason to stop drinking or using. And that was easy because, like, you know, a normal person would be like, oh, you dropped your kid, your baby, and then you didn't pick her up because you passed out. That's a pretty good wake-up call, you know. I felt bad about it, but it didn't stop me from drinking. You know, I got a laundry list of those. So that was really helpful, and that's something I do with my sponsees now, in addition to the big book and a lot of time talking. So, well, the first time I went through the steps, you know, with my previous sponsor, I came to believe that I had to be restored to sanity. But, you know, I've come to realize more and more that I have to be restored to sanity throughout the day, every day. Because I'm super insecure and I'm overly sensitive, a little bit grandiose. And I'm emotionally a little bit immature. I think I'm at like 17 years old now. I don't know. It's an interesting formula. I don't recall. But yeah, so, you know, I get my feelings hurt, and then, you know, and that's not fair. How could they talk to me that way? You know, I'm a grown man. I'm the man of this house. You know, that kind of stuff. I gotta say, so the last 3.5 years have been amazing. The promises have come true in time and time again. You know, what's interesting is that the promises don't say anything about what's gonna happen to you. It says everything about how you're gonna perceive and react to what happens. You know, my finances I didn't like get rich, and as a matter of fact, I got poor. My court date, so 3 months sober this time, right? My ex-wife, who's sick, she's a sick woman. The police arrested her for assaulting me, and I've had my daughters, my 5 and 8 year old now, for 3.5 years, sole custody. And that's not something that I've done. Sadly, it's the stuff that she's done since then. But 3 months over, they give a newcomer custody of these kids. And I remember thinking, like, I'm never going to put alcohol in front of these kids again. Never. And I meant it. But it doesn't matter what I mean. It doesn't matter the solemn oath. That doesn't mean anything. It's all about action. You know, it's the actions that I take every day that determine the outcome of my life. that determine whether or not I'm spiritually fit, whether or not I'm maintaining a spiritually fit condition, whether or not I'm maintaining conscious contact with my higher power, because I need help. And when you guys aren't around, that's all I have is God. And now don't get me wrong, I stay around you guys as much as I can, because there's God works through you. I believe God works through you. So the point I'm trying to make is that I'm still a mess. I'm still a mess sometimes. You know, today I was stressing about this court date next week and stressing about the fact that my ex-wife claimed the kids as dependents, even though it's like totally in the court order and everything else. And then stressing about the fact that I'm in a relationship that's going to end when I move, when I retire in a year, and that she's mad at me, and and I was being short with my kids. I was, you know, I told you three times, you know. And the thing is, when I raise my voice, it's scary, you know. And I went up there and I started talking to her, and I was like, honey, I'm sorry. Daddy is cranky and has a lot of stress right now, and it's not your fault. Man, I started tearing up. Because I felt so bad. Because they deserved me at my best. And left to my own devices, I will be a sick person who will eventually drink his life away. And, you know, it didn't take... Yes, I got 22 years of solid research on the topic. I do. I mean, but like I said, I can forget that in a heartbeat. I can forget it. And while the obsession to drink has gone away, I do have thoughts sometimes, and not often, but I don't romanticize them. And I don't hang out with people that romanticize their drinking thoughts. You know, I got to stick with people that want what we have. Not that are willing to go to any lengths to get it, that are willing to say God and talk about spiritual stuff and growth and service and love and kindness. You know, I try really hard to be kind and loving, and I fall short sometimes. You know, my ego is alive and well. You know what they say? You know, your ego is not your amigo, right? It's true. It brings out the worst in us. And resentment's the number one offender. And I have to treat people that are mentally unhealthy or emotionally unhealthy as sick people. You know, I can't be mad at them. And I got to remember that when somebody says something to me, it's a reflection of them, not necessarily a reflection of me. But I also have to be willing to take suggestions. Man, I don't know how long my sponsor was like, you need to read 286 and 87. And finally I got desperate and I was hurting enough that I started doing it. Yeah, pain. Because I don't know how much longer I would have gone, you know, but I started doing it. And recently they're sending out a group text saying, hey, let's every day let's read 84 through 87. And so I was like, all right. So I started doing that. And then, you know, another friend was like, read 62 through 87. I was like, well, that's a lot of good stuff in there. But it's, you know, it starts off selfishness, self-centeredness. That's like the root of our issues. Like, you know, it's not how much long I've been alive. It's how long I've been practicing this way of life that's kind of determines my maturity level. And it takes discipline, which is something that you do over and over again until it becomes routine. I'm so thankful that I was able to do a good step one and a step two, and then you know, the men's group that I was part of for a while, we read Drop the Rock. Starts talking about character defects, things like. Acting as if, right? So I have all these character defects, And I can't will them away. I can't, you know, fix a broken mind with a broken mind. I have to take actions, which means I have to act as if God has already removed those. Because that's what I'm supposed to do. It's my job. You know, there's like everything that we get in recovery comes from the work we put into it, which means I have to be willing to say, I'm being selfish. I'm getting disturbed. Hell, just tonight, before I came up here, before you guys came over to the house, I was like sitting there on the couch. I was like, God, please remove these fears, these resentments, this anger. Please remove these things so that I could be of service to you and your children. And normally I get off the phone and I call my sponsor or another AA. But I had two beautiful little girls in the other room sitting there without me. So I went in there and I was of service to them. And I sat with them and I loved on them. And I told them that they were good kids, good people. And I was proud of them, proud of them. And because I forget, I can't always see the forest for the tree sometimes. And start trying to control everything and hurting people's feelings. Because, you know, because I don't always trust God. You know, what Dr. Bob's prescriptions is trust God, clean house, and help others. And that's the steps broken down into three things. And it doesn't do me much good to have a higher power if I don't believe in him. You know, if I don't trust him, that it's going to be okay because he's got this. And, you know, I can't do this. You can, so I should probably let you. I have to do that a lot. And I don't learn these things by myself. I learn these things from coming around you guys. Suiting up and showing up. I don't normally wear this. Showing up for the meetings. Showing up at my sponsor's house or my friend's house. Calling people when I don't feel like calling somebody. Because if I do that enough, people start calling me. And then when I need it, the phone rings. And you know, I have such a good group of friends here and fellows. I'm gonna miss them when I have to move, but every time I go to Texas to see my family, my brother and I go to meetings together. What a beautiful thing. Man, we have never been able to, like, on a social level, connect. You know? Connect. He was always being the older brother. Got to be the older brother still. Only 2.5 years older. But got to be the older brother. Got to tell me how it is. And I'm like, dude, we're adults. You got to stop this, you know? But today, like, we talk about recovery, and we talk about real stuff that matters, and it's amazing. I got my brother back. These rooms saved my family. My mother has 2 sons, and both of them would have been lost to this disease. Both of us were, and this fellowship, this program, with God in charge. Brought us back from disaster, from a self-imposed crisis, right? And I can't forget, I made this mess, you know? Ninth step, I got to clean up the wreckage of the past, but I continue to make little messes as I go every day. And, you know, that's so, when I'm reading, you know, when we retire at night, I got to constructively review my day. Was I, you know, resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? I probably was. And yeah, always, usually am about something. And sometimes I'll get up and go say sorry to somebody, or if I can, I'll do it the next day. And the results aren't always like, you know, music and hugs, but I've also had results that were just mind-blowing. Like, just the relationships mended and strengthened like never before, you know, because I'm doing something that I learned in the big book. And and you know what I get after that? I get like peace, and I get joy, and I get freedom, you know, I get to feel happy. You know, I wanted to get sober because I want to be happy again. I was miserable. And And when I get unhappy or I get disturbed, there's things that I can do. Sometimes I suffer for a few hours, or at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, it's time to pray. And other times I do it right away, or I call somebody. But the quality of my problems today are nothing like the quality of my problems before. You know, I'm a decent person today. I don't have anything to hide. I don't have anything to hide. When I go to talk to attorneys and I go to court and I talk to the guardian ad litem, all I tell is the truth. And I don't have to worry about whether my story, you know what I'm talking about, you know? I shouldn't have drunk called her this time because I don't remember what I said. You know, I've done that. I've ruined a relationship with a half-sister because I kept calling her drunk and forgetting we talked already, you know? And she was done with me, you know? And I never got that back, you know? And, you know, but those are things that I did. I brought this on myself. And, but this design for living helps me to be of service to other people. And that is the most rewarding thing in the world. The legacies, you know, that I think about that I want one day is to know that I've had good relationships, that I've loved, you know, that I've really loved and been loved. And I get that today. You know, I have people that will help me with anything, that will help me on an emotional side, that will help me on a spiritual side, that will help me fix my kitchen. I got people to call for everything. And they do it with a light heart, you know, with willingness. It's not like, you know, they're real friendships, you know, not the fair weather kind, not the, you know, only if you're buying type, you know. So I think I'm running out I'm starting to ramble. But thank you for keeping me sober tonight. That's all I got.